3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present, of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double. Grab your hands.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR Community Radio. It is Monday, the 22nd of June. I'm Rob, and I'm here with Hannah.
Good morning, Hannah. Good morning.
We are so cold this morning.
It's so cold. It was winter solstice yesterday.
I thought it was on Saturday.
Pretty sure it was yesterday.
Or maybe it was yesterday.
And the days are only getting longer now.
Yeah.
From now on.
But it's going to be cold this week.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to get above like 15 degrees at all this week.
Yeah. Got to get some thermals.
So maybe time for thermals. Mm-hmm. How are you? How was your weekend?
It was good. It was busy. I went to a little winter solstice fire thing last night with soup, which is delicious.
What kind of soup did you have?
A pumpkin soup.
Yum.
It's pretty good.
I feel like I have been so skeptical of pumpkin soup for so long.
Why?
Just because I just had so many mediocre pumpkin soups.
Wow.
And then recently, I don't know when it was, like, I had a nice one and I was like, okay, now I understand what pumpkin can do. You know
I'm
what I mean?
I'm all about pumpkin soup.
It was the same with eggplant. Like,
what?
Especially because I've been, like, what? I went vegetarian when I was, like, 16.
Mm.
Just so many, like, bad eggplant dishes being served to me.
Right. Yeah.
And I was like, what the hell is this? Like, this is... And then, yeah, similar situation. Like, I just had eggplant that was, like, properly salted and had enough oil. And I was like, delicious. Wow, this is so yummy. What the delicious. Hell is, like, what is this vegetable I've never eaten before?
It's my favorite vegetable.
The eggplant?
Yeah.
Except interesting.
Well, that and potatoes.
What about Brussels sprouts?
No.
No.
I mean, I like them. Like, they're delicious. Just not the favorite. But, like, definitely not my favorite. Love a broccolini. Love an asparagus.
Yeah.
A little garlicky, buttery
underrated
asparagus.
Oh,
so good when you suck it up like a noodle. So good.
You eat asparagus like noodles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yummy.
Let's just, before we get too deep into vegetable talk, let's talk about what we have coming up on the show.
Mm-hmm.
So first up, we're going to be having a conversation with Ohad Kosminski, who is, listeners may know, he's a member of the Jewish Council of Australia. And last week, they published their submissions to the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion, which was, of course, triggered by the Bondi Beach attack last December. And very controversial, the Royal Commission, for its role in helping to perpetuate the conflation of any criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. But Ohad was also mentioning that he's also on the branch council of the Australian Education Union, which late last week voted to reject an agreement, an in principle agreement put forth by the union from the Victorian government. And he was involved in a collective within the AAU, trying to build rank and file activism within the union. And so Ohad's taken a very active role in organizing against this in principle agreement. So very excited with Ohad, to speak with Ohad first thing in the morning. That'll be after our headlines at around 7:15. And following that, we will hear from Buzz, who's from the COVID mask block here in Nam, and they distribute COVID PPE and many other vital things, including zines, which are anti-colonial in their theme, to the community, and it's fully community funded, similar to 3CR. So we'll be talking with them about how that mutual aid organization is going, and they're also a part of a campaign to raise money for air purifiers to donate to community organizations that need them to help keep more members of the community safe from COVID. And following that, that'll probably take us to around 8 o'clock, and following that we're going to continue playing some archival audio from the iconic S11 protest against the World Economic Forum conference back on the 11th of September in 2000. Thank you again to John Langer for creating and providing all of the breakfast shows with audio from that time. And the show's going to end with... Do you want to talk about what the show's going to end with, Hannah?
Yeah, the show's going to end with some more archival audio from 1978, from the Gay Liberation Show. Yeah, because it's 3CR's 50th birthday this month. We'll be playing as much archival audio as we can. Yeah, it is about lesbianism and on the Gay Liberation Show, speaking with a author on her book called We're Here, Conversations with Lesbian Women. And they speak about what it's like to be a lesbian in 1978.
That's going to be so cool to listen to.
Yeah.
And what an honor to be able to, like, go back and hear all this cool audio and replay it again, you know?
Yeah, it's great.
It's so exciting. Cool. Well, with that, well, we'll get into our headlines, hey?
Mm-hmm.
...3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty-gritty now. One, two, nitty-gritty now, yeah, boom. Nitty-gritty, who?
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show for the 22nd of June 2026. It is almost 9 minutes past eight in the morning. And these are the news headlines for this week. The US is planning to build warehouses to stockpile weapons in rural Victoria. Documents seen by French news publication AFP revealed last week. Some $42 million Australian dollars will be spent on building these warehouses in Bandiana, which is near Wodonga in regional Victoria. The tender documents reveal that the warehouse will be completed next year, with the stockpile expected to reach full capacity by 2028. Until then, the stockpile will be stored here in so-called Melbourne. An estimated 110 US military staff, ranging from engineers, mechanics, and safety specialists, will be employed to manage the stockpile. Representatives from the US Marine Corps Pacific Department said that the stockpile will aid the US in helping to respond to any threats that occur in the Indo-Pacific region, and its location in Bandiana is beyond the range of China's missiles, and is also the spot where the US Marines sort of have left. Apparently they've left like trucks and things from previous like war games stuff, whatever that means there. In other news this week, on Friday evening, New South Wales police stormed the public housing protest camp set up in Waterloo, removing dozens of community members and arresting one. The camp has been set up since the end of May and included tenants of the public housing block, as well as tenants of Aboriginal housing at the block in Redfern. Some 60 police officers cleared the camp to make room for the construction of the controversial Waterloo Estate redevelopment. Grant Donohue, a public housing tenant representative of the Martin Building in the Waterloo Estate told Green Left that the government is, quote, not fulfilling its obligations to refurbish these houses and maintain the buildings. We need to invest in new public housing, but why knock down perfectly sound homes that are only 50 years old? These buildings could easily be refurbished, especially in a housing crisis. It's silly that they're going to put a wrecking ball through these homes, end quote.
Also in news this week, on Thursday afternoon, a dozen activists held a peaceful protest at the Melbourne office of Thales. They were demanding an end to the exportation of weapons to Israel. Dressed in shirts with bullet holes and blood splatters, several activists went up to the third floor of the World Trade Center with posters condemning Thales and the Albanese government, with one banner saying, quote, "We make explosives for Israeli bombs." This protest was in response to the recent revelation that explosive chemicals are produced in Thales factories in Malwala and Benalla and are shipped to Israel through the US and Singapore, being done with the knowledge of the Australian government. Thales runs the explosive manufacturing and fills facilities in Malwala and Benalla and is the only company that can manufacture, design, and certify military solid rocket motors, exhaust nozzles, and rocket motor cases. In January 2023, Thales Australia welcomed the Australian government's $37.4 million contract with Lockheed Martin to start the manufacturing of the guided multiple launch rocket system from 2025. Protesters dressed as mourners paraded around the food court of the World Trade Center, handing out flyers saying, quote, "From Thales to genocide." These have been the news headlines for Monday, the 22nd of June, and you're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same.
I'm sick of the little boxes. Aren't you too? Do you want to live in nourishing green neighborhoods where we share and care for one another and our precious planet? Are you sick of greedy people gatekeeping better futures from the rest of us? Then listen to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence every fortnight on a Friday at 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on 3CR with myself, Amy, and the wonderful people taking back their cities.
And they all look just the same.
This is a rapacious expansion of privatisation, which is going to change the face of the city that we live in.
It's not share, it's not making the housing crisis go away. It's really about the big end of town. It's a shame job.
It's a transfer. It's a theft of public wealth, which is going to worsen the housing crisis.
The government is giving public land to private developers. Why would you do that? Why would you give all these assets over to the biggest bully in town?
We're looking down to a future that we don't know what's going to happen. Where are we going to get moved to? Dandenong? Or away from our communities and away from the services that we need.
This is a line in the sand for not only the public housing tenants, but for a Victorian society.
3CR, here to stay.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM. Just a quick reminder before we move on with the rest of the show that we are still in Radiothon mode, and we are still raising money to try to survive another year. If you'd like to call up and donate, you can call 94198377 or go to 3cr.org.au/donate and you can nominate a show of your choice, hopefully the Monday Breakfast Show, to the show to keep us alive for another year. 3CR is fully community funded and as such is relying on the community to stay alive. Now we'll be hearing from Ohad Kuzminski, who's a member of the Jewish Council of Australia. Last week, the anti-Zionist Jewish organisation published their submissions to the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion, triggered by the Bondi Beach attack last December and mired in controversy for its role in helping to conflate any criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. OHAD is also a branch, is on the branch council of the Australian Education Union, members of which last week rejected an agreement put forth by the union from the Victorian government with a vote of 57.7 of its 60,000 strong membership against the agreement. OHAD was involved in organising against said agreement and will also be talking to us about that. He is also part of a rank and file group called Fight the Crisis, set up to build rank and file activism within the union, which also took an active role in organising against the in principle agreement. OHAD, if you don't mind, I'd like to start talking about the Jewish Council of Australia's involvement in this Royal Commission. As an organisation dedicated to Palestinian liberation and equality for all, what was it like contributing to this Royal Commission against anti-Semitism and social cohesion?
The Royal Commission is continuing and we are hoping to continue to contribute to it. It's very important that we have been able to contribute, that we have a voice, that we have lawyers in the room representing us as a portion of the Jewish community. So often pro-Israel Jewish groups make the claim that they speak for all Jewish people, and that's patently false. But there are many Jewish people who are critical of Israel, many Jewish people who are critical of the political ideology of Zionism, and many Jewish people who recognise that Jewish safety is bound up with the safety of other racialised groups, both in Palestine and Israel, and here in on this continent as well. And so it's been really important for us to participate. We've participated by cross-examining some of the expert witnesses that have been brought, by making our own submission, and by sharing witness statements from many of our members to the Royal Commission. And we're hoping to get a chance to be heard in future hearings.
So, obviously, your submission included something like, what, it was over 2,500 Jewish voices, right?
So we have a list of supporters, of Jewish supporters, that's on our website. I think we're getting close to 3,000. I haven't checked it recently. Those are people who are willing to sign up. We also know there are a lot of people who are very supportive of our work and of our public positions but have not signed the supporter statement. That's separate to the work we did in the Royal Commission, where we asked a lot of our members to firstly to submit, to make their own submissions to the Royal Commission, and I myself did one, but also to work with us to develop witness statements that could be seen by the Royal Commission in the hope the Royal Commission will ask them to give testimony.
And all of that was sort of amalgamated into a number of recommendations by the Jewish Council of Australia. What did they look like?
So we made quite a number of observations and recommendations in our submission. At the forefront, we recognise that anti-Semitism is real, and it's important to recognise that and to combat that, but not as an exception, not as something exceptional, but as one form of racism that is bound up with other forms of racism. And we know that when racism emerges, it affects many racialised communities. So we also made the recommendation that efforts to combat any form of racism by punitive legislation, by these very dangerous definitions that have been adopted in some institutions that conflate Israel, the country, with Judaism, the ethnicity and religion, and also efforts, so the punitive legislation, those definitions that involve conflation, and also efforts to silence political dissent. These efforts don't reduce anti-Semitism, they actually make it worse. And it's really important to recognise that the far right, you know, with its great replacement theories, its Holocaust denial, and the ways in which it's being picked up by mainstream conservative politics, all of that is a driver of anti-Semitism. And we know a lot of significant figures in One Nation, in Pauline Hanson's party, buy into these narratives. And we know that all of that needs to be attended to if racism across the board is addressed. So in that context, that the first recommendation that we ask the Royal Commission to address or to recognise is that our community, the Jewish community, is politically diverse and it's religiously diverse, that many Jewish Australians are critical of Israel, critical of Zionism, and any response to anti-Semitism which treats the Australian Jewish community as uniform in its views and values, and unquestioningly supportive of the Israeli state. Any efforts to address anti-Semitism that have that assumption or those assumptions, we know it will fail and will make things worse. And we've even seen that in the Royal Commission so far. The next recommendation is that conflation that I mentioned, that conflation of Jewish identity with Israel drives anti-Semitism because it identifies Jewish people with Israel's genocide. So any definition of anti-Semitism, such as the ones that are being thrown about, perhaps most prominently the IHRA definition, does more harm rather than protecting us from anti-Semitism, it exacerbates it. Again, the next one, as I mentioned before, any of these punitive approaches, the hate speech laws, the criminalisation of slogans, as we saw in Queensland with the River to the Sea, the suppression of protests, particularly those horrors that we saw in New South Wales, all of those approaches target minorities and dissenters. They don't protect them. And we've seen that in many, many cases. The next one recommendation that we made is that education, intergroup contact, cross-community solidarity, we know it's the most effective measure to reduce prejudice and hate. And the government is serious about investing resources into combating racism across the board. It has to invest in that education, intergroup contact and cross-community solidarity. And the final recommendation we made is that the National Anti-Racism Framework, which has been developed by the Human Rights Commission, is sitting on the shelf where it really needs to be implemented. It needs to be implemented. This is, again, a framework for addressing racism that doesn't silo off anti-Semitism from other forms of racism, but addresses racism as a whole. And that's pretty much it.
Thank you for that explanation. I just wanted to move to quickly talk about the International Holocaust Remembrance Agency, also known as the IHRA, their infamous definition of anti-Semitism. What role would you say the Royal Commission has had in exacerbating perpetuating that definition, which is obviously conflating criticism of Israel with that of anti-Semitism?
So the IHRA definition is in the terms of reference of the Royal Commission. And so, to an extent, the Royal Commission doesn't have a choice about whether it needs to take account of that definition. That said, we're in the middle of the Royal Commission, and to understand the impact of that definition, we're in early days yet. We need to see what findings, what recommendations emerge from the Royal Commission before I can answer that question definitively. But as I've said, we've argued very strongly. We've urged the Royal Commission in the strongest terms to not recommend any definition, such as the IHRA definition, that conflates Judaism with Israel.
And obviously, as you said, the Royal Commission is still ongoing, and so it's hard to really say, but how widely has this IHRA's definition been adopted across the continent?
Across the world, there are institutions across the world that have adopted it in various contexts. And what's really important about the IHRA definition is that it is a non-legally binding working definition that was developed for research purposes. That said, it has been implemented by institutions in a way that has, again, conflated Jews in Israel and has served to silence speech in a various context. It's a site of contestation here. So various government institutions have adopted it, but the significance of that adoption has varied too. It's a very difficult question to answer in general terms. There are institutions, for instance, the Victorian government has adopted it. So that's one example. But that adoption, what that actually means in practice is another question.
Yeah, I appreciate you trying your best to answer that question. I'm aware it's a difficult one. Obviously, last week, the Australian Health Practitioner Regulation Agency, known as APRA, also adopted this definition. What are your thoughts on how that will affect healthcare workers advocating for a world in which their profession, well, people who work in healthcare aren't targeted by Israel?
So again, this is an example that worries us deeply. Healthcare professionals should absolutely be able to advocate for the human rights of Palestinians. That's really not a question. That shouldn't be a question. We have a network of Jewish health workers who are quite angry about this too, and who are hoping to find ways to push against it. But yeah, look, as you say, it's a real worry. It's a real worry for us, and it's part of a trend that we are hoping we can intervene into through the Royal Commission to ensure that IHRA doesn't become a norm that serves to not only silence people but intimidate people, and in that way silence them. Just with the threat of potential adoption or potential sort of implementation of the definition in punitive industrial context.
I just want to ask one last thing about this definition before we move on to talk about other things. What role has the Jewish Council of Australia played in opposing this definition?
So we've just spoken out publicly using every channel we have, arguing against the definition, and really putting forward the National Anti-Racism Framework and putting forward, as I've said, in those recommendations, measures whose purpose is to treat racism as a collective problem that requires a collective solution. And we've continued to make the argument that the IHRA definition, when used institutionally, actually exacerbates anti-Semitism rather than dealing with it. So we've made that point in government, we've made that point in the media, we've made that point on the ground in community, and we've stood with our allies across racialized communities making that point and arguing for a whole of society approach to the problem of racism, which we know is on the rise.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. We're currently on the line with Ohad Kosminski, who is a member of the Jewish Council of Australia. And we were just speaking about the organisation's publication of their submissions to the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion, which was published last week. Ohad is also part of a rank and file group called Fight the Crisis within the Australian Education Union, which was set up to build rank-and-file activism within the union and took an active role in organising against the in-principle agreement, which last week was rejected by a vote of 57.7% of its members here in so-called Victoria against, and so the agreement was shut down, rejected. Yeah, Ohad, maybe you want to tell us about the offer and how long it's taken to receive it.
Yeah, absolutely. I do wear a few hats. it's a busy time and a tiring time, but these are fights that are really worth participating in. I am just a teacher by day, and I'm active in this group, Fight the Crisis. We have been active for some time now, within the union grassroots, at our workplaces, and also a few of us are elected to the branch council, which is the highest decision-making body of the union. We're far, far, far from the majority, but we play a role in the debates in that room. So we had an opportunity to look at the in-principle agreement at a meeting last month before the membership saw it. And the membership saw it in the afternoon. We saw it in the morning, and we clawed through it, and there was a lot in there. There was a lot in there, and we had a lot of concerns, and me and my fellow and those councillors who are part of my network and a few others voted against it. The reason we voted against it was that we had a log of claims. So the log of claims is a process where every single union, every workplace, contributes to the claims that the union makes when they entered the negotiations with the government. And that log of claims was a response to a crisis that we're experiencing in education. We have a teacher shortage. We don't have a teacher shortage because the work is not magnificent, because the work is magnificent. The work is highly rewarding and essential work as well. The reason we have a teacher shortage is the conditions and the pay. And this log of claims sought to rectify that. In the past, the government has made the argument that there is no money, there's only a certain amount of money, so we can only do so much. And the view of my caucus, of my group, about the crisis, is that there is money, the government has priorities, and they need to recognise that they can't take teachers for granted, and that their priority should be ensuring that our education system is sustainable and that it allows young people to flourish. So getting down to the nuts and bolts of what that looks like, we took an effective pay cut in the last agreement, and the pay rises that were there were below inflation. So really at the front of our agreement was over a three-year period, a 35% pay rise. That does sound like a lot, but given inflation and the cost of living, what it really allows teachers and school staff of all types to actually maintain their buying power, which is actually a very humble demand, but an absolutely necessary one. The agreement as it stood went some way to that, over 4 years rather than 3 years and less than that, but it also gave different pay rises to different groups of workers in a way that was highly divisive. In particular, education support staff were not offered the full pay rises, but these very complex payments at the end of the year. And the argument from the government, we are told, is that they did not recognise the professionalism of education support staff and their qualifications or their duty of care to young people. And that was very infuriating for us, that effort to divide us that came from the government. And that's one strong reason why we said no, in addition to the inadequate pay rises. There was also that divide and conquer approach that frustrated us. In addition to all of that, teachers in particular are deeply concerned about the conditions under which we work. There are small things that could change that wouldn't cost the government money, but a lot of teachers are crying out for. Things like a reduction in mandatory meetings so that we can do the work that we need to do, our assessment work, our planning work, and our collaboration work. Further to that, we were arguing for a gradual reduction in class sizes, a gradual reduction in face-to-face time again, so we can really do the work supporting young people to flourish. And that very much is our calling. It feels like our vocation to a lot of us, and we really want to live up to it. All that said, there were some positives in the agreement that we were happy to see. For instance, in the past, teachers basically went on camp for free. We weren't given overtime of any kind, even though we were 24 hours of, and education support staff do, 24 hours of duty of care for young people. In the last agreement, some timing loose and payment for time off was afforded to people who take camp, but there was also, or stayed after school for programs, but there was no funding for it. And that led to a lot of frustration and conflict within schools, within workplaces. In this new agreement, some money was allocated to time and loose for camp, which for us was really valuable, but not for other forms of work that was done, that is done outside of hours. There were also a few extra curriculum days that were allocated to us as well. One final matter to consider is that we are still not being, schools are still not being funded to the minimum standard that was set in 2012, and Victoria is actually the laggard. Most states are not there yet, but they have a path to getting there. There were some leaks that you may recall in the media a few months ago, and it seems that the Victorian government didn't even want to commit to its part of funding the minimum standard when the federal government said that they would finally, and far too late, commit to that minimum standard. And so we really want to see that being baked into the agreement so that we don't have a situation where certain measures are in an agreement, but they're not funded, which then leads to conflict at workplaces where principals who are concerned to not run too far into deficit and conflict with workers who are demanding the rights that are in the agreement. And we don't want to see that. We want to see collaborative, warm, supportive workplaces right up and down the hierarchy. And our agreement and our funding should facilitate that. It shouldn't be a source of conflict. It should be something that smooths out any possibility for that kind of conflict.
I'll just remind our listeners again that you're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. I'm currently on the line with Ohad Kosminski, who is both a member of the Jewish Council of Australia as well as an organising group known as Fight the Crisis within the Australian Education Union. And we're currently speaking about the member vote last week, which rejected the principle agreement with a 57.7 vote against the deal. What was it like organizing? Obviously, you mentioned that the deal did cause some division within the education world, based on how long people have been in their jobs and what kind of role they do within the education sector. Yeah, what was organizing within that space like?
Can I say it was incredibly thrilling and empowering? There are so many members who are recognizing the depth of the crisis and are really experiencing their collective power. And I'd say for me, for the first time, I mean, I've been teaching for eight or 9 years, so this is the first time I went on strike recently, and people could really see, we could see one another, and we could see our shared power and the conversations that we were having, and the incredible expertise. Like, teachers are such qualified, capable people. The kinds of mathematical and artistic and analytical expertise that have been brought to bear in interpreting the, and digital skills as well, in interpreting the proposed agreement and then communicating about it. I've visited sub-branches and fielded questions, and to see the passion in these different workplaces, sub-branches of workplaces, my apologies, so the passion in those workplaces has been also really quite thrilling. And I would say as well that I've had this experience of I have an electorate as an elected councillor, and of hearing back from various workplaces and the things they're saying has been very similar to what I'm hearing in my own workplace. And I had one other thought that feels very important. My apologies, I think I've lost that other thought, but maybe it'll come back.
That's okay.
I've got my thought, thank you.
Yeah, go on.
So my thought is this, is that there have been so many people doing so many things and people who I've yet to meet. So around this agreement, our grassroots have just grown and built, and I've felt that we actually don't depend on any one of us. There's this deep feeling that some of us can step back. Sometimes I'm doing other work and other organising, and there's just, quite often I am, and there's so many people who are stepping up and doing things, and it's really been thrilling, I think, for everyone.
That's really beautiful to hear. Mm. How have the rank and file members of the AEU that you have been in contact with, how have they felt with how long the government has taken to offer this deal, especially considering that any rise in pay wouldn't have been back paid, right?
Yeah, look, it's clear that, I mean, we don't trust this government. We know that they will only give what they are forced to give and what we demand. And our argument is not just with the Department of Education. Our argument with the Treasury. They are yet to commit to funding schools to the minimum standard, right? So there is, again, a lot of frustration amongst the membership for the Labor Party as it is currently being led. There are many, many people who are AEU members who have been Labor voters. So we know that the Labor Party, I think the Labor Party should be a bit concerned that it is angering not only teachers, but many teachers are also parents. And many parents listen to trust and support the teachers who educate their children. That is something the Education Department should be concerned about, that the government, more importantly, should be concerned about.
What has it been like for you, particularly Ohad, as you know, a member of the Jewish Council of Australia, as well as a member of the AEU, like in sort of in both cases, right? Just organizing against actions of the government.
Yeah, look, I love community organizing. I mean, that's the answer. I think I do this because having conversations with people, listening to them, helping them to imagine what's possible and helping them to realize what they imagine and being a part of a process, feeling like it's never just me. It's only possible because there's an us, there's a collective power behind us, and I'm just a cog in that wheel. It's a really thrilling experience for me, and it's incredibly fulfilling. And even as a teacher, there's a similar sense. It's very different because I don't teach when I organise, but as a teacher, I also am doing the same work of helping others to be empowered, and so doing helping them to empower me. But it's not necessarily terribly just a hierarchy, a top-down thing, but it's in the reciprocity of the relationship that we're both empowered, and we're all empowered. And yeah, look, I will raise with that organising. I think it's an incredible undertaking, and we're all capable of it, and we all need to be doing it. And I just encourage everyone who's listening to think about how they can do that in their community and in their workplaces.
And to ask what you can do for the union movement. I just have one last question, Ohad, before I let you go. Obviously, now this offer has been rejected. What is next for Fight the Crisis and for the AEU?
Great question. So at the council meeting yesterday, there was, again, really healthy debate about next steps. Our group, Fight the Crisis, was in the minority. We argued for strike action to really be scheduled without delay. The majority in the room argued for a survey, members to be surveyed, and for the results of the survey to return after the school holidays, and for action to be taken on the basis of that survey. We think we don't have any time to waste. We've already been surveyed many times in this process. I mentioned the log of claims. Following the log of claims, there was a vote for that industrial action called the protected action ballot. Something, PABO was the acronym. We've also had many debates with our workplaces, and we've had this vote of 57.7% as well. So our view and my view is that there's been enough surveying of the membership, the members they spoken, and they've called for the campaign to continue. And part of the campaign and part of putting pressure on the government is taking decisive industrial action. My concern is that there is an election in November. We know the Labor government does not want to be in a protracted dispute with teachers and school staff during an election campaign or in the lead-up to an election campaign, but that members need time to consider any future offer. And as soon as we put pressure on the government, the sooner and decisive and forceful pressure on the government, the sooner a better offer will be proposed and we'll be able to consider it without the pressure of the upcoming election. And without being told, oh, you better sign this agreement or else you're going to ruin the election for us and you're going to get One Nation and all these other kind of scare tactics. Our argument at the council and our argument outside the council, and I was just at a strike committee meeting just earlier today, our argument is that we need to be taking strike action decisively and quickly to ensure that we can get an agreement that is commensurate to the dignity of our members and the dignity of our students.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show to speak about these two huge things that you've been a part of. And absolutely. You're welcome back on the show at any time to talk about both of these things.
Thank you so much.
We have a right to be in public space, undertaking political activity. That is not something that people should be telling us that we can't do.
Multiple actions rolling over months and years and create huge sustained pressure of social change.
And what we're seeing around the country right now is increasing repression of protest.
Protest works. That's why I think we're seeing it criminalised all over the place. 3CR. Stay tuned, stay radical.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. That was a conversation with Ohad Kosminski, who is a member of both the Jewish Council and the Australian Education Union, speaking about both the Jewish Council of Australia's publication of their submissions to the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion, as well as Ohad's role in organizing against the in-principle agreement that was voted down on Friday afternoon, and what is next for the union. And now we're joined live in the studio by Buzz, who is a member of the COVID Mask Block here in Nam. For those who are unfamiliar, the COVID Mask Block distributes very important COVID PPE and many other vital things, including anti-colonial zines, to the community, and is currently raising money to buy air purifiers to donate to organizations and keep their members COVID safe. Good morning, Buzz.
Good morning.
Maybe you want to be just a little bit closer to the mic, actually. You've been running, you've been a part of the COVID Mask Block for some time now. Mm. What is the state of the block?
We're doing really well. So I founded the Mask Block in 2024. And at the start of this year, we actually hit 5,000 face masks distributed.
Wow.
And 1,000 rapid tests as well.
Yeah. And of course, all of that is community funded, right?
Yes.
And distributed.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's really amazing. So talk to us about how the state sort of fails us in providing COVID PPE, except, you know, the pandemic is obviously ongoing and continuing. How does the state, how has that decline happened?
Honestly, I don't even think it was a decline. I think they never really gave us the proper support to be safe. They kind of took like a military-esque, like, do it for your country approach to like vaccines. And they used police to try and get everyone to mask. But the thing is, masks were really hard to come by. I feel like they could have actually led from a community-centered approach of like, oh, you're not wearing a mask, here's a free mask. Instead of like, oh, you're not wearing a mask, we're going to beat you up on the street in broad daylight. And, you know, like, we have such a massive manufacturing industry, but it's all focused on, like, defense, quote unquote. I feel like we could have just, like, sidestepped all of the imperialist munitions and stuff and just turned those factories into, like, PPE factories somehow. I don't know how that would work, but
It sounds much simpler than just, like, hey, we're going to employ a bunch of cops to, like, find people mostly from marginalized communities.
Literally.
For not wearing masks that the government hasn't provided, right?
Right. There's been studies to show that Indigenous communities in Western Australia were the hardest hit by fines. And then, like, if they don't pay their fines, they go to prison. So it's just, like, it's just another arm of Australia oppressing Indigenous people. But, yeah.
And obviously the COVID Mask Block is working to, not to fill that gap, but just provide an alternative to the state.
We don't want people relying on the government when the government doesn't do anything for us. So we're just trying to get the resources out there, because I truly believe if the resources were there, a lot more people would mask. People are just, like, so overwhelmed by, like, the lack of information that they don't really know where to begin. So we're trying to, like, fill that gap locally.
And I think there's a lot of, like, knee-jerk reactions as soon as you start speaking about COVID or wearing a mask. There's so many, like, is this your experience as well? Like, knee-jerk reactions of just being like, people are so touchy about it, you know?
Yeah. I think some people are just, like, a little bit traumatized. And then I think others are just like anti-vaxxers. But I think a lot of people have buried their heads in the sand a little bit about COVID and the fact that it is ongoing. It hasn't stopped. So I think when they see someone who is masked or they see someone who's talking about it, they're like, oh, now I actually should be worried about it. I can't just keep my head in the sand. Yeah.
And I found that, like, I mean, I mask sometimes, and I found that it's a lot easier than you think.
Yeah.
You know, like, I even go to the gym wearing a mask. Like, exactly. I've lifted weights wearing a mask. I'm like, it's not really that difficult.
And, like, you know, you can just wear, like, any regular mask to the gym. I've worn, like, tridents to the gym, which I don't recommend. Do not wear tridents to the gym. But, like, there's, like, specifically masks where they have, like, a little vent in them, so it's easier for you to breathe. It doesn't hold so much carbon dioxide in the mask. It's really good for exercising. But the only thing is it only protects you. It doesn't protect others, which is where it kind of needs to be, like, a community effort. Like, everyone at the gym wearing those masks would be protected and still be able to, like, breathe better.
So how do you're also a part of a campaign, I guess, to raise money to give – to buy air purifiers and donate them to community organizations. How do air purifiers, like, fit within the COVID PPE world?
So we at COVID Numb Mask Block employ the Swiss cheese method in everything we do. So, like, you've got one piece of cheese, which is, like, wearing a mask that protects you a little bit, but there's still some holes there. Like, if not everybody's masked, there's still a risk of transmission. If the seal's not right, you might get sick. But then you put on the next slice of cheese, which covers up some of those holes. So things like air purifiers clean the air. If you have an air purifier with a, I think it's a HEPA filter. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. It will actually clear virus particles from the air, stuff like COVID, RSV, et cetera. So that kind of works for people who can't mask or people who don't mask. It is really important for the mask block to kind of, like, emphasize it's not a moral failing to not mask. You know, there's been so much, like, miseducation around masks that I think sometimes people are like, oh, if they're not masking, they deserve to be sick. And it's like, no, actually, nobody deserves to be sick. So this is just, like, one method to help everybody, regardless of if you mask or not.
I think that's such an important mindset, especially if I remember, like, the first time we talked, we were talking about, you know, approaching this from an anti-colonial mindset, right? It's like you also just need to stop policing other people within our own community.
Exactly.
Yeah, cool. So how is the campaign to buy air purifiers?
It's going really well. So our goal was 500. We're up to, I think, 300 last time I checked. So we've got enough for the first one. And I think we'll have enough for the second one by July, which is our goal.
Wow.
We want to install the air purifiers mid-July.
Yeah.
And we also want to make sure that those community places also have some masks. We had about $100 in the block account before the campaign. So we've used that to purchase AMD face masks, which are very comfortable. We have a billion Trident masks, but they're not the most comfortable for everyone. So for community centers specifically, like Southern Block Nam, we're going to give them the AMDs, the ones that are comfortable for everyone. So it encourages masking in those spaces.
Yeah, so talk to us more about, like, the process on who to, like, who you're giving the air purifiers to and yeah.
So we're just kind of in the trial phase right now. So we're giving it to one group at Catalyst who reached out for support with better air, like clean air. And we're also giving it to Southern Block Nam, which is, like, a community organizing space in the south. We want to kind of work with the community. Like, we're not really, like, strict on who we give it to. If it's, like, a local business who can't afford it, we'll do that. If it's a space like Catalyst, we will give them an air purifier. Basically, like anywhere that people are gathering, we're happy to help. But we do want them to have kind of like a decolonial aspect of their work. We don't really want to just give it to anyone and then just like some racist shows up and is like, hey, I want an air purifier. You can use your own money for that.
Yeah.
So yeah, basically if you're anti-colonial in some way, you don't like Australia, we'll give you a free air purifier if all goes well. We're aiming for one per quarter per year.
That's huge. Yeah. If they're, what, like $250 each?
Yes, they are. $250 secondhand off the marketplace.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how hard is it to acquire like masks in bulk?
It depends.
Yeah.
So we actually got a massive donation from Aventura Diagnostics. They gave us like 20 or 30,000 face masks, which I'm very grateful for. Thank you, Stephen. So that was quite easy. I just put in an order and he was like, oh, I saw your a mask block. We'll give you a donation. So that's probably the easiest I've ever gotten bulk PPE.
And they're like N95s.
Yeah, they're all Tridents and Halyards, like really high quality masks.
Damn.
Yeah, and they're all in date. There's no expired ones.
Wow.
Yeah, I was.
I didn't know that masks expired.
Yeah, they do. They've got a pretty long shelf life. And after they expire, honestly, they're still usable. Most of the time when they expire, it just means like the little rubber bands have like gotten older. So maybe they're not as protective. But there's been studies to show that expired N95s are only like 1% or 2% less effective. So if you have an expired mask, you can still use it.
It's okay. Yeah. Okay, cool. I just quickly want to talk about the zines, because that's a recent like initiative that the block is doing, distributing anti-colonial zines.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Like 2 or 3 months ago, I was feeling a bit burnt out with everything. And I was like, I need a project that's fun for me with this block. And so I was like, okay, let's distribute zines because I love zines. They're one of my favorite things in the world. Basically, anyone on this continent can request a zine. We do zine of the month. So for the first one, we had a zine, which was about COVID and Indigenous perspectives, which was actually written by one of the new members of the block.
Cool.
But well before the block existed, like 4 years before. We had such a good response to that one. I think I printed off like 10 or 15 zines in preparation, and we ended up having, I think, 30 requests for zines.
Wow.
Which, to be honest, we only usually get 20 to 30 requests a month. So for 30 of them to all want a zine is really good. And then this month, our zine that we're distributing is The Lettersome Raid by Jasper Cohen-Hunter of the BPU. Highly recommend it. We have closed requests already, but one really cool thing that we're doing is in our Signal announcements chat, we send the PDF through every month.
Cool.
Yeah, so if you miss it, there's a digital version.
I love that.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll just close off the conversation with just reminding listeners maybe like how they can get in touch, like if they want to request masks or if they're part of an organization that would like an air purifier, or even like how they can support the block monetarily, because 3CR is also similar to the block, fully community funded. You know, we don't take any money from the government.
That's so good.
And we've done that for 50 years.
That's so good. Inspiring, honestly.
Yeah, it's amazing. So, yeah, maybe you could just tell our listeners, like, how they could get in touch with the block.
The easiest way is the Instagram, which is at COVIDNARM. NARM spelled N-A-A-R-M. You can also join our Signals chat, which is links on the Instagram. Or you can email us, COVIDNARM@protonmail.com. We answer those once or twice a week. Yeah, that's the easiest way, is just contact us on one of those.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming in to the studio so early in the morning. And good luck with distributing your masks.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yay.
This is fun.
Have you heard of long COVID? If you or someone you know have had COVID-19, You may still experience symptoms weeks or months later. There are many symptoms of long COVID, but the most frequent are extreme tiredness, shortness of breath, and muscle aches and joint pains. Anyone can experience long COVID, including children. You can find information in your language on the Health Translations website, healthtranslations.vic.gov.au. Just type long COVID as a keyword.
A 3CR supporter.
LGBTIQA plus people, that's come from a large history of people standing up and acting up for our rights and our communities.
Talking queer Pacifica, talking about us.
You know, this very like violent act of like hatred and bigotry towards trans people, where they demonise the image of trans people, especially trans women.
For working class queers, for queers of colour, for those who are poor and homeless, the struggle is continuing.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
Celebrating 50 years.
3CR Community Radio Melbourne is Australia's first community radio station owned and operated by a federation of community organisations.
Hello and welcome to the very first edition of Women on the Line, the national programme of women's news and current affairs.
We're at our new studios in Cromwell Street, Collingwood, and the new, brand spanking new transmitter just north of the Collingwood Town Hall.
This is the whole importance of having 3CR and public radio, is the fact that for the first time, you were hearing a black person's view about his life.
It does represent a unique achievement in democratising the airwaves, not only in Australia, but in the world.
3CR celebrating 50 years.
Make your donation during our annual radiothon. To donate, call 03 9419 8377 or go online at 3cr.org.au.
Every day, people in prisons across Australia are subjected to strip searching. It is an unnecessary, degrading, and deeply harmful practice that must end. It involves a person literally being stripped of their dignity, forced to remove their clothing for their bodies to be inspected by prison guards, being forced to submit to humiliating requests like bending, squatting, and spreading their legs. In many prisons, people are subjected to this repeatedly and routinely. Children as young as 10 years old are being forced to remove their clothes and have their bodies inspected by adults. We're calling on the federal government to stop state-sanctioned violence by ending the routine, unregulated use of strip searching in prisons across Australia. Go to endstripsearching.com. Together, we can demand a system that upholds dignity, safety, and human rights. Fig Jam is a 3CR supporter.
When I was new to Melbourne, I found a Food Not Bombs flyer on the road, and I had like this fist with a carrot, and carrots are my favourite vegetable. Yeah, I think they were asking for help doing stuff, and I got in touch.
We, I guess, rescue food
that would otherwise go to waste.
I like the aspect of sharing food and not making anyone feel obligated to pay anything for it.
We make a real point at Food Not Bombs of involving everyone who wants to be involved in whichever part they want to be involved in.
For more information, go to fnbmelb.noblogs.org. Food Not Bombs is a 3CR supporter. Food Not Bombs.
Or you're not the world of mine, dog.
барандара чуть-чуть на урма дуал гундурион марите.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. That song was called Rarunda by Drifting Clouds, who describe themselves as the most chill band out of Arnhem Land. Rarunda is the hot and dry season, simply known as the dry season to non-Yolngu people, about the end of the dry season and moving on to colder, wetter climate. Yeah, what's next, Hannah?
From the 11th to the 13th of September in 2000, members of the World Economic Forum met at the Crown Casino Complex in Melbourne. 3CR covered the massive public opposition to the WEF and corporate-led globalisation and has compiled some of the highlights from the broadcasts on a CD, Globalization Unplugged. We're going to be playing a compilation of some archival audio from this protest, and 3CR would like to thank all the people who contributed to the material on this compilation and those who added their voice to the protest.
In essence, of course, the globalization is actually the push by the big companies to break down the national barriers. Big companies and financial institutions, of course, to grow more, with more power, to grow bigger, to take over our countries and make more profits. They've lobbied their governments, and their governments are the ones that are very much have a voice in the international institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO.
Global free trade, which is their mantra, is designed to make the accumulation of every kind of wealth possible on an unprecedented scale. At whose expense? At ours, the majority of people.
First, by creating these rules of trade which allow these corporations to get so big that they can then undercut in 10 places for 10 years and still make money. Because they've taken over the most vital areas of our life. They keep talking about the new economy, they keep talking about information technologies, as if the new economy is computers. The new economy is the commodification of the very basis of our life. That's what the new economy is. It's the potential of a Monsanto to claim to give away rice that doesn't belong to it to growers in Asia. Rice has evolved in Asia. It belongs to the people of Asia. It can only be Monsanto's through theft.
Their response to these questions raised, obviously the big impact being made by the blockade is that they'll just have to sell their message more effectively. Their response seems to be, well, we obviously have been missing the mark as far as advertising and promoting ourselves goes, and we'll have to do that more effectively in the future. Not that this is a serious problem, we need to sort of fundamentally change the way we do things.
Only if we think that the shocking irresponsibility and secrecy with which
The Monsantos and Novartises have foisted biotechnology on us is a departure from the corporate norm. Only if we see as deviations from the normal shall systematic devastation of Ogoni land in Nigeria, the Seven Sisters conspiracy to prevent the development of renewable energy sources in order to keep us slaves to a petroleum civilization, Rio Tinto and the mining giants' practice of poisoning rivers and communities, and Mitsubishi's recently exposed 20-year cover-up of a myriad of product safety violations to prevent a recall that would cut into profitability. Only if we think that if it is acceptable business practice and ethics to pull up stakes, lay off people, and destroy long-established communities in order to pursue ever cheaper labor around the globe, a process that most TNCs now engage in. No, these are not departures from normal corporate behavior. They are normal corporate behavior.
I'm up against one of the biggest companies in the world called Western Mining Company. They made an $800 million profit last financial year.
According to transnational capital, any government regulation that gives a preference to public transportation over road transportation is a barrier to free trade in transportation services. Any government regulation that says public funding for universities, for schools, for hospitals should only be received by public sector institutions is regarded as a barrier to free trade in education, health and welfare services.
But we were just speaking to someone before who said that they've started helicoptering some people onto the top of the roof.
Quite likely. I presume they always had that as a contingency for certain, you know, high-powered VIPs. But the bottom line is that for the bulk of delegates, I can't imagine they'll be able to get them all in through that form of transport. It's highly inefficient.
The Common Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those involved in community campaigns and social and labour movements. It collects, curates and distributes key lessons and resources from progressive movements from around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 1,400 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, justice, equity, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org.
We were just listening to a compilation of the S11 protest, which happened from the 11th to the 13th of September in 2000. Where people were protesting members of the World Economic Forum where they met at Crown Casino in Melbourne. Breakfast shows over the next week will also be playing compilations of audio from this protest too. And last up on the show, with it being 3CR's 50th anniversary, we'll be bringing you some archival audio from the Gay Liberation Show, which first aired on the 11th of October 1978 here on 3CR, about Jules Cassidy's book on lesbianism called We're Here, Conversations with Lesbian Women. Stay tuned.
Hello and welcome to the Gay Liberation Program. And tonight we have an interview that Pierrette did with Jules Cassidy. This week we'll be talking to Jules Cassidy, one of the writers of We're Here, Conversations with Lesbian Women. As it says on the cover, this book is not trying to prove anything about lesbians. It's just to say, we're here. What did you hope to achieve with this book, and did you feel you achieved it?
Well, first thing was that at the time when we decided to do the book, there were in England very few books about lesbians at all available to the public. Those that were usually written by men or written for men for male titillation. Either that or they were written by straight psychologists or sociologists, those sort of people in a very academic way. And nowhere could we find a book that presented just ordinary lesbians to the world, saying what they think, what the problems in their lives, their struggles, their joys, their just ordinary things like that. And we thought that it was important that a book be written by lesbians, about lesbians, rather than the straights telling us what our lives were like or supposed to be like, especially for women who live isolated lives, who don't live necessarily in London or the big provincial centres where there is some gay life. So if someone's questioning their sexuality or wondering where to go or what books to read, things like that, then there is something available to them in London in particular. But outside of there's nothing. And so if there was just one book somewhere that says it like it really is, rather than how the straights tell us what it's like to be gay, then we thought we would have achieved something. So that's basically what we set out to do, and I think we did achieve it. I mean, I wish the book had sold more. I mean, I'm not saying that it hasn't sold very many copies, but I wish it had had a wider distribution. We were hoping that it could be sold on railway bookstalls and things like that, but I'm afraid that book distributors are a bit too uptight for that to happen, and it wasn't as widely distributed in provincial centres so ordinary women could get their hands on it as I would have liked.
What publishing difficulties did you have?
Well, I don't think we had any publishing difficulties really at the time. At that particular time, Quartet were very interested in the gay movement. I think they probably saw a few pound signs clicking up as well out of the new gay consciousness and people wanting to read gay books and so on. So they hopped right in on it. But they also, I think, at that particular time, though I wouldn't say that that's the case now, things have changed at Quartet Books, but at that time they were smaller liberal in their politics. So they were anxious to promote things like that. So the publishing way for us was made very easy. I mean, we didn't have to get this idea and go around to lots of publishers, tramp the streets of London and rejection slips coming through the mail and all that sort of stuff. They approached us to do the book. We went in and saw them, we talked about it, and then we went and did it. And then when we'd done it, they accepted it and it was published.
Mm. Did you interview many women, or was it just you approached 11 women?
No. What we did was, there were a number of women that we knew personally who we approached to be in the book. Then we talked to Dennis Lemon, who's the editor of Gay News, about the idea, and he thought it was a very good idea, and we got a lot of support from Gay News for it. And they did an interview with me and Angie about it, where we asked, you know, women to write to us or to contact us through Gay News who were interested in the idea and who'd be prepared to be interviewed. We did the same thing with Sappho, with Jackie Forster. And a lot of women wrote to us, and we saw most of them, and we sort of narrowed it down from that. And as well as that, the four of us, that was me and Angela, and JP, who was our photographer, and her lover at the time, who drove the car. We went on this dyke tour around England to all the major centres, down in south in Bristol. We went up to Liverpool, to Manchester, up further north, Newcastle, all around England. And we met people in clubs and through the women's movement and in the bar scene and all over, and talked to them and interviewed a number of people. And from that, Oh, I don't know how many we must have had. I can't really remember now.
How did you go about choosing the women you were going to print?
Well, there was a number of criteria. We wanted to get as large an age range as possible. So the youngest we got was 20, I think, which I would have liked to have got someone like 17 or 16 or so, but just wasn't possible at that time. And we also had lined up an interview with this 86-year-old woman who's been in the suffragettes and been a pacifist and so on, and been a lesbian, you know, all her life too. But in the end, she backed out because she said that she was her energies were more. She wanted to give her energies more to the pacifist cause or the cause of world peace or something, so we couldn't get that together. But it was basically we wanted to have as large an age range. Class also was another thing. We didn't. I mean, there are a lot of articulate middle-class radical lesbians, but we didn't just want that because that's not the truth, I don't think, of the ordinary lesbian existence anyhow. Mm. There are far more ordinary, just ordinary women out there who are lesbians than there are radical lesbians who live in the ghetto who are articulate and able to present, you know, those kind of ideas. So we had, two or three women, radical dykes, but we also wanted to get women who hadn't had any contact with the women's movement and didn't have those ideas, just to find out what the life of ordinary lesbian was like. So women who were trapped in similar situations could see that there were ways of getting out of it, because these women had all got themselves a consciousness of one way or another, of one kind or another. So that was class, age. We did consider also there was a question of race, which is quite important in England. But in the end, there aren't that many black women who are prepared to stand out, black lesbians who are prepared to stand out, speak out, come out. And the one or two that there were, and we talked with them about it, and we decided in the end, and they decided they felt it'd be too much like the token black. So we didn't include, in the end, any black people, black women. But we did have an Irish woman, and a European woman, and an American woman. And that was basically also, I mean, there were things like interest of the interviews, and some were better than others, and you know, some people were more able to present their ideas or so on in a more interesting way. And I'd just like to say also that when we went around, the four of us, on that tour of England, our Dyke tour, I did learn an awful lot, I think, about what, I mean, I've been saying this already, but I haven't really articulated it very clearly. The situation that most ordinary lesbians find themselves in, which is horrific, really. And living in London, where it's all fine, and, you know, there's a million clubs to go to, and there's lots of dykes, and whatever you're into, whether you're, you know, a bar dyke or a radical dyke or a university, you know, intellectual kind of, there's everything there for you. And life is difficult. Being out with things like the National Front breathing down your neck, and people do get queer bashed and so on, but there's not that loneliness and isolation. And I mean, we know about that in theory, but just going to visit some of these women that had written to us, I mean, some of the stories you heard and that were just horrific. They make your hair stand on end, really. And we met this woman right up in the north of England, and in this little town in the north, and she was just totally isolated and quite off her head. And she used to write into all the Lonely Hearts sections of all the gay magazines she could get her hands on, and ring up women and get replies to these letters, and just tell this whole tissue of lies and this complete fantasy existence that she lived. And I mean, she inveigled us up there, and I mean, it was totally unusable, the interview, but it was just quite a freaky experience. And just going around and seeing the kind of what oppression does and what isolation and loneliness does, to lesbians, which is something that I'd never realised. And if our book goes any way towards making women in that situation feel that they're less alone or less lonely, as we said in the introduction of the book, then I think it's served its purpose. Because we got a lot of flack when the book came out in London from the highly political dykes, particularly ones that were in lesbians and the left and in the Communist Party and things like that. I think they thought we should have used the opportunity, that publishing opportunity, to write a lesbian manifesto, a real political manifesto, kind of, you know, this is the past, this is the present, an analysis of society, and this is the blueprint for the revolution or the lesbian revolution. And there was a controversy, quite a big controversy about that. And I could understand what they were saying on one hand, but I think that for me it was more important to, as a political act, to do what I could to help women in that, the thousands and hundreds of thousands of women that must be in that situation. Because if you think about what the Kinsey report, which is a very conservative estimate, says 1 in 20 are homosexuals. The population of England's 50 million, half of that must be women. That makes 25 million. That's over a million lesbians in England on a conservative estimate. They're not all in London running around the ghetto holding hands and, you know, it's okay. They're out there. And I think that they're, to help them is a really important thing. And I think radical lesbianism, the women's movement, has totally lost sight of that completely. And they just put bar dykes down. You know, they're just role-playing bar dykes. They're not interested in them.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. That was some archival audio from the 3CR archives back in 1978, in which host of the Gay Liberation Show spoke with Jules Cassidy, who's author of the book We're Here, Conversations with Lesbian Women. That was provided to us by the Australian Queer Archives. Thank you very much to the folks at AQUA for providing us with that and much more of the audio. We've only got a few moments left of the Monday Breakfast Show, so I'll just mention what else we had before Women on the Line begins. We started the show with a conversation with OHAD, from the Jewish Council of Australia and also the Australian Education Union, speaking about the Jewish Council of Australia's submissions to the Royal Commission against Anti-Semitism and Into Social Cohesion, as well as the campaign to reject the in-principle agreement offered to the union by the Victorian government, which was rejected on Friday. We also heard from Buzz, member of the COVID mask block here in NAM, talking about distributing COVID PPE and also anti-colonial zines. We heard some archival audio from the iconic S11 protests back in the 11th to 13th of September 2000 against the World Economic Forum and corporate-led globalization. Thank you to John Langer for providing us with that audio. There'll be more of that on the rest of the breakfast shows throughout the week. And yeah, the show ends with another set of archival audio from 1978, featuring a conversation with Jules Cassidy, author of the book We're Here, Conversations with Lesbian Women. With that, stay tuned for Women on the Line. We will see you next week.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.